It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a look at the newly released documents laying out the White House case for a drone attack on an American citizen.
First, the United Nations issued a report on World Refugee Day saying that over 50 million people around the world have been displaced from their homes by war and conflict, the highest number since World War II.
That number includes people seeking asylum or refuge in other countries and people displaced from their homes but still in their country of origin.
Jeff Crisp joins us now. He's Senior Director for Policy and Advocacy for Refugees International. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon.
Well, what countries and which conflicts are driving the recent growth in the number of displaced people?
Well, unfortunately, there's quite a lot of them. We have a number of long-standing conflicts which have been going on for 10, 15, or even 20 years in some cases, which nobody has been able to bring to an end. And I'm talking there about countries such as Afghanistan, Somalia, Burma, and Iraq, where things have turned very bad just in the last couple of weeks. But just in the last 4 years, we've had a whole sequence of conflicts in different parts of the world, but particularly in Africa, which have driven many, many people from their homes and forced them to take refuge either in other parts of their own country or in other states. And here I'm talking about countries such as the Ivory Coast, Mali, the Central African Republic, South Sudan, most recently Syria, of course. This has been one of the largest and fastest refugee movements we've ever seen in recent years. 2.5 million people leaving Syria just in the last 3 years. And there's more trouble ahead, I think. We're looking at countries now such as Nigeria and Ukraine, which are very unstable, where there's already been some displacement and where there threatens to be new refugee movements. So all in all, conflicts in different parts of the world are driving this new trend of increasing numbers of refugees.
Now, this 50 million refugees figure that we're talking about that was recently released, this represents a big jump, doesn't it, from the previous report?
Yes, according to the United Nations, during 2013, every single day, on average, 32,000 people were displaced. So if you average that up, you're talking about 10 million people just in the course of 2013, and that's really what has caused this very major spike in the refugee figures. And as you mentioned at the beginning, this number of 50 million is split between those who have remained in their own country and those who have left their own country to flee abroad. And in fact, the number who remain within their own country, what we call internally displaced people, is actually almost twice as many as the number of refugees. According to the UN figures, there are 33 million internally displaced people and 17 million refugees.
So these are people who are considered refugees within their own country, the internally displaced. How does their plight differ from those who are fleeing their country?
Well, often they're actually in a worse situation because those who get out of the country are often able to leave the conflict zone and at least find some kind of peace and stability in the country where they take up residence. But the internally displaced populations are often people who are unable to escape from their own country. They're trapped in between the front lines. We've seen this very graphically and very tragically recently in Syria, with large pockets of people simply not being able to get out of their towns and villages because of the fighting taking place all around them. And so those people are actually often more vulnerable than those who manage to escape. Similarly, delivering assistance to people who are inside conflict zones is much more difficult than delivering assistance to those refugees who have managed to escape from their own country. So these so-called internally displaced people are often in a very difficult situation, much worse than that of the refugees who escape.
Now, those who are fleeing their countries, their first stop, I imagine, would be the bordering countries around them where they have to be absorbed in. What kind of challenges are present there?
Well, you can imagine when you've got thousands of people crossing the border every day into one of the less developed countries, and we have to remember that 85% of the world's refugees are to be found in the world's poorest countries. This places an enormous strain on local resources and on the local infrastructure, on food supplies, water supplies, on the land, on the environment. These major refugee influxes do exert very serious pressures on the countries that host the refugees. And of course, those countries in recent years have been very vocal in requiring and requesting international assistance so that they can cope with the massive number of new arrivals that are coming onto their territory.
What is the longer path for those that are fleeing their home country? Are they then given different options of applying for asylum in different countries besides the one they just entered?
Well, unfortunately, we have another situation that we refer to as protracted refugee situations, and those are situations where refugees have been living in exile for more than 5 years without any opportunity to go back to their own country. And another trend pointed out by the United Nations in its recent report is that growing numbers of refugees find themselves trapped in these long-term refugee situations. They can't go home because the conflict and human rights violations that drove them out of their own country are still taking place. The countries where they've taken up residence won't allow them to integrate there and to become citizens of those countries. And yet, for the vast majority of refugees, the opportunity to move on to another country is also very limited. Of course, some refugees do move on, usually by illegal or irregular means, because they can't get the visa and passport and tickets that they need to travel in a regular manner. But the number of people who manage to leave developing areas and come to the more industrialized states, such as the U.S., is a very limited number of people indeed.
Now, you mentioned earlier a large number of refugees right now coming from the current conflict in Iraq. Can you give a sense of what's happening there and how many people are affected?
Well, just last week, around 500,000 people were displaced when the ISIS forces, the militant forces, attacked the city of Mosul in the north of the country. Some of those people have remained in Iraq proper, and some of them have crossed into the area known as Kurdistan or northern Iraq. There does seem to have been some backward movement back to the city of Mosul in the most recent days, but a very large number of people are still displaced as a result of the most recent fighting. And of course, there are large numbers of refugees and internally displaced people that have been created since the military intervention in Iraq in 2003.
A very interesting quote from the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. He said last Friday, "We're seeing here the immense cost of not ending wars, of failing to resolve or prevent conflict." So is that then the highest priority, ending conflicts that create refugee situations in the first place?
Well, I think this is what's really concerning us in the humanitarian world. There's been a lot of emphasis on the relief that is needed, the aid and assistance that is needed to sustain the people who have been displaced by the recent conflicts that I've already mentioned. But, of course, humanitarian aid cannot bring conflicts to an end. And we're really looking to the political and diplomatic realm to actually address these conflicts and to bring peace back to the countries that I've mentioned. And unfortunately, the international system, the global governance system that was set up by the United Nations at the end of the Second World War, is simply not, as the High Commissioner mentioned, it's simply not functioning anymore. If we look at Syria, for example, we can't even get a Security Council resolution to allow food to be shipped into the country from neighboring countries, let alone get any kind of resolution to the conflict itself. So it is extremely worrying with these new conflicts emerging, such as Nigeria and Ukraine that I mentioned, that we don't have a system in place that is able to bring these wars to an end.
Well, if the international cooperation angle isn't working, then it sounds as though the focus is on the other side of things, helping the refugees who are with us right now. So when we look at that perspective, what are the priorities?
Well, certainly there is still a need for life-saving assistance in the traditional sectors, food, shelter, water, sanitation, etc. That is absolutely essential, particularly in the early days of an emergency, before the refugees have had any opportunity to find work or to establish livelihoods and make ends meet by themselves. They're desperately in need of such assistance. But we in the humanitarian world are saying increasingly vigorously that the politicians have to come together, because with so many crises taking place at the same time, the humanitarian system is simply a stretching point at the moment. And if there was one or two more emergencies, it's very difficult to know how the international community would be able to cope with them.
So if we're at the breaking point right now and you're saying you see trouble on the horizon, what happens then when more refugees are created due to conflict in their area?
Well, humanitarian agents will simply have to prioritize, if that's the case, and will have to look after the most vulnerable people, those who are most at risk, most of those who can't look after themselves in any shape, sense or form. And some of them, maybe other less priority programs, will have to be scaled down. But that, of course, is going to inevitably bring about suffering and hardship to the people concerned. So it is quite a gloomy scenario looking forward.
Part of these figures include children, children without parents, children have been separated from their families. Can you talk a little bit about how children in particular are affected as refugees?
Well, many press reports recently have pointed out the fact that a very large proportion of the world's refugees are children. In a sense, we shouldn't be that surprised, because a very large proportion of the population at large in developing countries are people who are under 18 and therefore qualify as children. But so the numbers are one aspect, but I think what we should focus more on is the hardship brought to the children who get displaced. One particular area that I'd like to mention is that of education. If we look at the Syrian children, for example, 2.5 million refugees outside the country, but 6 million people displaced within Syria. Many of the Syrian children have gone completely without schooling for the last 3 or 4 years. And as the conflict drags on in Syria, it's going to be difficult to see when they're going to get back to school and when they're going to be able to catch up with the time that they've lost in their education. And this is going to have a permanent effect on their lives and on the lives of the countries where they're living. It's a very difficult situation for children who are not in school. Often they get involved in various kinds of coping mechanisms which are not good for them. The parents find it very difficult to control their kids when they're not going to school on a regular basis. And so this is a major concern for us.
Jeff, what would you like to see from the United States when it comes to meeting the needs of refugees?
Well, one thing I can say with certainty is we really can't complain about the performance of the United States. It's by far the most generous donor to international humanitarian organizations such as the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. In Syria particularly, it has played an enormous role in providing assistance to the Syrian population, particularly the refugees who have left the country. So I think what we would like to see is the United States to continue that level of support. When the economy is in not great shape, it's always tempting to cut overseas assistance. That hasn't happened so far, and we would simply hope and pray that that continues to be the case.
Jeff, thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you very much indeed.
That was Jeff Crisp, Senior Director for Policy and Advocacy for Refugees International, talking about the United Nations announcement that over 50 million people around the world have been displaced from their homes by war and conflict.
A long secret memo that lays out the Obama administration's justification for killing an American citizen in a drone strike was released yesterday. It's raising questions about the country's drone program and the secrecy surrounding it.
Our next guest says there's a lot more in the memo that helps rather than hurts the administration, and the lack of transparency caused more problems than it solved.
Joining us now is David Cole. He's a professor at Georgetown University Law Center. He's also the legal correspondent for The Nation. David, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with some background. Why was this memo kept secret for so long?
Well, it was written in July 2010 to lay out the legal foundation for whether the president could authorize the military and the CIA to target and kill Anwar al-Awlaki, a U.S. citizen then living in Yemen. And that was, at the time, obviously, a covert operation involving the CIA in an ongoing armed conflict, and therefore was involved a great deal of classified information. And in addition, many memos like this, that is, memos written by the Justice Department for internal use by the executive branch, are not published and disclosed to the public as a general rule.
And in reading the non-redacted parts of the released memo, was this really geared toward this one person, Anwar al-Awlaki, or was it setting a precedent for other similar strikes?
Well, it was very much geared towards the targeting of Anwar al-Awlaki. He is the only U.S. citizen who thus far has been targeted and killed. There have been three other U.S. citizens who have been killed as essentially collateral damage in attacks targeted at foreign nationals. But he was the first to be identified as a U.S. citizen being targeted for a drone strike. And so there was, you know, understandably significant concern within the administration as to whether or not this would be legal and how various laws that, for example, make it a crime to kill Americans abroad might apply. And so the memo is directed towards that specific question. However, the analysis that it adopts did, I think, ultimately guide the administration in some of the standards that it ultimately announced that for governing its drone program.
So what did it lay out? What was the rationale justifying a drone strike in this particular case?
So, the memo redacts all the facts concerning Anwar al-Awlaki. So we don't really know much other than what's been leaked. But what's been leaked is this is a guy who was said to be the leader of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which is an al-Qaeda kind of spin-off group. In some view it as part of al-Qaeda, others view it as working alongside al-Qaeda in the fight against the United States. He had been centrally involved in planning the foiled Christmas Day bombing in which the underwear bomber sought to explode a plane over Detroit on Christmas Day, 2009, I believe. And he'd also been involved in another foiled attack where bombs were to be placed in printer toner cartridges and explode several cargo planes simultaneously flying over the Atlantic from the UK to the United States. And so the CIA said, look, we know this guy is a bad guy. He's the leader of this organization. This organization is fighting us alongside al-Qaeda. Can we, and he can't be captured. His capture is not feasible. He's in Yemen. He's in ungovernable territory. And we can't capture him. Can we kill him? And so what the memo's authors ask is, in a situation where an American citizen is part of the enemy fighting force against us, where Congress has authorized the use of military force against that fighting force, where he poses an imminent and continuing threat to the lives of U.S. persons, has been involved in past attacks and is planning future attacks, and where his capture is not feasible, is it lawful under federal statutes, under the Constitution, and under international law to target him and kill him without charges and without a trial, even though he's a U.S. citizen? And the memo concludes it is, because Congress has authorized the use of military force. Military force includes the authority to use lethal force against the enemy. This guy fit the bill of the enemy. And according to the facts, as set forth by the CIA and the military, he couldn't be captured and he posed an imminent threat. And under those limited circumstances, the memo says, it's lawful for the president to authorize his killing.
Let's key in on that imminent threat point, as I think you did in something you've written since this memo was released. I think you pointed out that it was 15 months between the memo and the drone attack. How imminent a threat was he is a question that some are raising.
Right. No, I think it's a very good question. And the Obama administration has taken the view that it can target and kill people who pose what it calls an imminent and continuing threat. And in some sense, that's a contradiction in terms. If a threat is imminent, that means it's about to happen. And it's not, if it's continuing, then it's not imminent. It's a long-term threat. The whole idea behind the imminence requirement, at least with respect to the killing of a U.S. citizen, is if he doesn't pose an imminent threat, then you are obligated to attempt other means to incapacitate him, to capture him, to strengthen the forces over there so that he cannot engage in bad action against us, to use surveillance and the like. And only if he poses an imminent threat would it be permissible, without charges or trial, to use deadly force against such an individual. So that was the reasoning of the memo in July of 2010. And the military said to the lawyers, look, he poses an imminent threat. But then the military sat on that memo and did not pull the trigger to kill Anwar al-Awlaki until September 2011, 15 months later, which really raises questions about whether he truly posed an imminent threat, or how elongated is the administration's conception of an imminent threat.
We're talking with David Cole about the drone memo released yesterday offering the White House justification for a drone attack that killed an American citizen, targeted and killed an American citizen who was involved with an al-Qaeda organization or organization that worked with al-Qaeda. Questions have followed the release of that memo, including why it took this long to release what they did. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234.
Well, what was your reaction to the content of the memo? Should American citizens, under the right circumstances, be the legal target of a drone strike? And would you like to see more transparency when it comes to the nation's drone program? Our number is 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking with Georgetown Law Professor David Cole about the drone memo made public yesterday. In it, the Obama administration lays out their rationale for the drone strike targeting an American citizen and alleged terrorist suspect in 2011.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Now that we've heard the administration's justification for the killing, what do you think? Should it be something that the U.S. is able to pursue policy-wise in the future, or do you have legal concerns? And would you like to see more transparency when it comes to the nation's drone program? Call 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll go to your calls in just a moment. But David, before we do, let's pick up on that transparency issue. You write that you think the Obama administration did more harm than good to itself by not being more transparent about its justifications here.
Well, that's right, because, you know, for a long time, the administration refused even to acknowledge that it was had a targeted killing program. It refused to acknowledge that it killed Anwar al-Awlaki or any of the several thousand foreign nationals that it has killed with drones. And therefore refused also to set forth what, if any, limits there were to its exercise of this authority. And so the message that that sends to the world and to the American people is the president has this power to, you know, order someone to push a button and kill people halfway around the world that is entirely in secret, that appears to operate under no set of clear rules and is entirely unaccountable. And that, of course, raises and has raised tremendous skepticism about the validity of the program around the world, and it's, you know, it's come to be viewed almost as negatively around the world as the torture program that President Bush put in place. And I think had he been more open about the program, had he, for example, disclosed this memo much earlier before a court ordered him to do so, I think people would have seen that he's not asserting some unchecked authority. He's not saying he can kill any suspected terrorist he wants wherever that person is found. He's asserting a rather narrow authority, the authority well established in the law of war to kill the enemy during an armed conflict, and in particular where the enemy poses an imminent threat to your side and cannot be captured. And if the world had seen that from the outset, that it's a limited authority, much more limited authority, then it, I think, might have been more accepting, and drones would not have become a kind of rallying cry and recruiting tool for the enemy.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got Rob on the line in Milwaukee. Rob, hi.
Hi, how you doing, sir?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, first I wanted to say that I do, I agree with the guests' opinions on self-harm the administration's been doing with a lack of transparency and what is, I think, a pretty clear-cut and dry solution to a warfare problem. But I wanted to offer a little insight. I spent a few years overseas working in these sort of programs, and the 15-month thing that people have been talking about as to why was this sitting on a table, you have to understand a lot of these proposals for solutions to, you know, asymmetric warfare problems are comprised and planned and written well in advance because they require an exact opportunistic moment to execute that we never really know when those things will happen. You know, the Obama administration has been really good as far as having very, very stringent requirements to conduct these types of strikes that require many different intelligence disciplines to offer many different perspectives to minimize collateral damage. And you're talking about people who hide out in hills and caves that don't have electricity, that don't have cell phone reception. And it's important that people understand that 15 months for someone that important who could be hid that well is not a large amount of time for an operation like that to wait for an opportunity to strike.
Rob, thanks a lot for bringing up that perspective and sharing that with us. So, David, we write the legal justification today. The opportunity might come tomorrow or in 15 months or never.
Right, and I think that makes sense, although you still have this question lurking. Did he really pose an imminent threat in July of 2010 if the United States felt, you know, that it could wait 15 months to kill him in September 2011? And did he, or if he posed an imminent threat in July 2010, does he still pose an imminent threat in September 2011? And one of the problems I have with the program, you know, continuing going forward is the complete lack of transparency and accountability with respect to how these rules are applied in particular cases. In Israel, they recognize the right to use targeted killing in an armed conflict context, but they require that there be an ex post review by the courts to ensure that the action was in fact necessary, was in fact fit within the legal requirements. And here there is no after-the-fact review. So it may well be, as the caller suggests, that there were perfectly good reasons why it took 15 months and that he did continue to pose an imminent threat. But without some, without an assessment of that, we just don't know. A couple of months ago, there was a report that a U.S. drone strike in Yemen struck a wedding party, killing most of the wedding party. There's been no acknowledgement that we even were behind that strike, no attempt to have some kind of post hoc review and accountability. And I think that contributes to the skepticism that the world feels and contributes to the illegitimacy of the program.
Has this been called for by anybody, say, in Congress, that, that we need this kind of review after these targeted drone strikes?
I don't know. I don't know whether specific members of Congress have called for it. Certainly, you know, many commentators have called for it. You know, people have pointed to the Israeli example as an example showing that it can be done and that it's, you know, likely to give legitimacy to the program. You know, but the bottom line is pretty basic. You when you're exercising the authority to take a human being's life, and particularly one of your own constituents' lives, without a trial, without charges, you know, you've got to, there's got to be something that ensures that there are very strict rules and that the rules are followed. And right now, we don't have that because the rules have been largely secret and the actual implementation of the practice is entirely secret, even after the fact, long after, you know, the need for secrecy is gone. The administration refuses to give any information about, for example, how many innocent civilians have been killed, how effective the program has been, how many people they have killed. None of that has been provided by the administration. And that, I think, you know, creates, makes people fear the worst, whether justified or not. And I think the disclosure of this memo shows that sometimes when we fear the worst, it's not justified. That is, this memo, I think, is actually a pretty good memo. But we continue to have a program that is run almost entirely in secret and therefore I think is seen as illegitimate by many around the world.
Well, this memo provides some transparency when an American citizen is the target. Do we have any kind of comparable transparency if it's not an American citizen?
Well, that's a great question. And you know, the administration in May 2013, but right before President Obama made a major national security speech at the National Defense University, they for the first time acknowledged that they had killed four Americans in drone strikes, Anwar al-Awlaki and the three others I mentioned before were essentially collateral damage in other strikes targeted at others. But they have never acknowledged the killing of the several thousand who have been reported killed under the Obama administration alone, and several hundred more under the Bush administration. None of those have been acknowledged, and we don't know whether memos were written with respect to those individuals, whether the same rules apply to them or not. And again, that just fosters the sense that the United States is not playing by the rules. And it may well be playing by the rules, but if it is, why can't we say so? Why can't we be open about what we're doing?
these memos came out in part because of a court order, because of a legal challenge to this. I assume a lot of that centered around the fact that there was an American citizen. Could something comparable happen with a non-citizen? Could a court order a release of similar documents?
Oh, yeah, it definitely could. I mean, in this case, the ACLU and the New York Times were aware that this memo existed because the existence of the memo had been leaked, and they specifically requested it the under the Freedom of Information Act. And the court largely ruled that because the administration had put out a kind of very truncated, unclassified version of this analysis in what it called a white paper that it distributed to members of Congress, the court held that it couldn't justify keeping the rest of the memo secret. So, you know, that it was an unusual circumstance in which the United States had already disclosed some aspects in a limited way of what they were doing, and therefore the court held you have to disclose most of the memo. They did allow them to redact the facts concerning Anwar al-Awlaki. So I'm sure there are other memos involving other individuals. I don't know whether there's one for every targeted person, but there's, I'm sure, a number of other memos. But whether courts would order the disclosure of those under the Freedom of Information Act without the administration having, in some sense, sort of shown its hand with respect to those memos, I don't know. But my broader point is I just think, you know, it's in the administration's interest to make these things public, and it's in the interest of the rule of law for them to be public.
David, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Bye-bye.
That's David Cole. He's professor at Georgetown University Law Center and legal correspondent for The Nation.
It's time for our Teaching What You Know segment. Every week we learn something new with experts about a wide variety of things. Last week we learned how to roast our own coffee beans at home.
This week we have a creative entrepreneur here to teach us how to sell our handmade crafts. She's Carrie Chapin, author of The Handmade Marketplace, How to Sell Your Crafts Locally, Globally, and Online. Carrie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
So a lot of people are out there making crafts, maybe as gifts, things for friends, that sort of thing. How do you know when you're ready to take that stuff to start selling stuff?
Well, there's a couple of ways. People could be asking you if they could buy what you're making. So perhaps people see you wearing or using something that you make and they inquire about purchasing it. Or you're just ready to make some extra money and you have a gut feeling that selling what you make is a great way to start.
And what do you need to ask yourself before you take the plunge?
Do I really, really, really want to do this? If you have a hobby that you genuinely love doing and it's how you decompress or de-stress at the end of a long week or day, turning that into a business can often sort of kill the love of having a hobby that you really enjoy. So what you really need to ask yourself is, do I want to turn this thing that I love into a business, which carries a whole other set of responsibilities and commitments with it?
And how about goal setting? How much you're going to try to make? What? How much money you're anticipating? How do you evaluate that?
Goal setting, I think, is one of the really most important things that we all do when we decide to start a business. And it plays into how successful you're going to be, how much time you need to spend, and how much money you need to make. So one of the things I like to recommend is that people sort of pick a point where they want to be in the future and then work backwards from there. So do you want to make enough money to pay for a vacation that you have coming up? That's a very different workload than the kind of money you would want to make if you wanted to replace your current income from a full-time job somewhere else. So deciding where you want to end up and then working your way backwards is a great way to get your goals on track.
So before we get to the practical points, how important is it to have, I guess, an identity as a craftsperson, a brand, as opposed to just, I made some stuff, buy it?
It's really important to have a brand. There's a lot of competition online. There's a lot of noise out there in the world. People want us to buy a lot of different things. And being able to set yourself apart with your own brand not only makes you look more professional, which builds trust, and can increase the perceived value that potential customers have in what you make, it can also help you make more money. So it is really important to decide who you're selling to. That's one of the other beginning steps that you need to decide to do if you want to go into business. Who do you want to sell to, and how are you going to reach them? And a lot of that has to do with your brand.
So let's say the way we want to reach people is online. I know there's a booming movement towards selling crafts online, or it seems that way. Suppose I'm really good at my craft, glass blowing or whatever it might be, but I'm not an internet savvy craftsperson. How would I get started selling online?
Well, first of all, take a look at some businesses that are selling items you personally like online and see what you already have in common with them, or if they're utilizing any strategies that you think might work for you and the audience that you're trying to reach. And so starting there with finding some good examples is a great place. If you're not comfortable selling online, then perhaps, you know, or being online, then maybe selling online isn't the place where you would want to start. But it is the best way to sell your items and the way to reach the largest audience. So just take some time to educate yourself and start slowly and do things you're comfortable with. And like anything else we learn to do, your skills and your confidence will build as you go on. And before you know it, you'll be an expert.
How hard, if we do take the plunge and go online, how hard is it to take one of the existing sales sites out there and set up shop?
It's not hard at all. In fact, it's really, really easy. There's even great video tutorials on websites like YouTube that can walk you through it so you can watch somebody else do it. One of the advantages of starting out on an established online marketplace is they sort of walk you through what to do because they want you to have a successful online shop. So they really hold your hand while you're building your store on their website. And also there's a lot less choices to make when you go with an established online marketplace. A lot of their branding is already in place, so you just might need to fill in your own copy or fill in your own shop banner, but a lot of the choice is actually taken away from you. So it's a good way to start if you're unsure about online business.
All right, so I've got my profile set up on one of these sites, and I've got a whole bunch of glass tumblers I want to sell. How do I present them in a way that people will want to buy them?
Well, you need to make sure that you have the best photographs possible. One of the main reasons people cite that they buy products online is because there's really, really good photographs. So a lot of people make their purchasing decisions based on what they can see when they're shopping online. So good photographs is key. The second thing you need to do is make sure that in your item descriptions, you are describing the item so well that even if there wasn't a picture there, but of course there is, somebody would understand fully what they were buying. That includes measurements, materials made, how you're going to package and ship it, how long it takes somebody to get it. So works. You need to have really great copy and really great photographs.
So I've been doing this craft for years as a labor of love. Now all of a sudden I have to put a price tag on my labor of love. Whether I'm online or at a craft sale, how do I know how much to charge?
Ouch. That is a tricky question that most people have a lot of trouble with. My best advice is to make sure you're a little uncomfortable with your price. Make it a little bit high enough to where you feel like, well, huh, and that's a great place to start. One of the most common mistakes handmakers make in the beginning of their business is undervaluing their work and therefore pricing it too low. And when you do that, you not only hurt yourself and your business, but you hurt your creative community as well. Take into consideration all of the time you spent making your product, the cost of materials that went into it, the time you're taking to list your item, the time it's going to take you to ship it, to send it, to drive it to the post office, or whatever it is you're going to do to get it to my house. All of those things need to be factored into your price. And most importantly, profit. If you're not making a profit off what you make, you're not really in business. You're just giving your stuff away for cost. And that's not our goal here. We want to make money.
Well, suppose that instead of or in addition to going online, we want to hook up with old-fashioned art and craft sales. How do we get a table there, and what do we have to do to sell stuff?
What you need to do is first scout out a show. It's never a great idea to apply for a show that you have not been to as a customer or that you don't have any really good, solid information about. And that's because you want to make sure that your ideal customer is actually shopping at that show. It won't do you any good if you make crazy, funky jewelry for teenagers if the main customer who shops at that show is a different demographic. So you want to make sure that the show is a good fit for you. Then you want to find out about their application process. That can usually be found out online. And you want to make sure that you follow the directions exactly. A lot of people get very enthusiastic when they're filling out these applications and they supply additional information or they don't put in enough photographs because they think this one photograph is so great, that's all I need. And that's not what the people who are deciding who comes to the show needs. So follow those directions exactly and then cross your fingers. Doing craft shows is a great way to start out, and they're fun to go to and investigate, and it's great to get to be able to speak with your customers face-to-face. You often get on-the-spot feedback about what you're making and what you're pricing. So I really recommend craft shows, particularly in the beginning of someone's handmade business journey.
And how do we build a long-term relationship with the people we meet at a craft show, with the people who buy from us online?
Well, you can have an email list, which is what lots of people like to do, but you can't add people to that list without their consent. But if you're at a craft show, you can easily have a little piece of paper there that says, sign up for my mailing list, or have your iPad ready to go so people can enter their emails when they purchase from you. And you want to have a website and a social media platform in place so that you can communicate with people that way, and hopefully you can drive them to your store or to your newsletter so that you can stay in touch.
All right. Any last words of encouragement for someone who's maybe getting ready to take the plunge?
Yes. Just do it already. Just begin. So many of us spend so much time researching, thinking, plotting. Just get started.
And then learn from our mistakes after that first effort.
That's right. Don't give up, but just get started.
Carrie, thank you so much for joining us.
You're so welcome.
That's Carrie Chapin. She's the author of The Handmade Marketplace, How to Sell Your Crafts Locally, Globally, and Online.